The big box stores invaded the neighborhoods, corroding community in favor of free market domination. The indie bookstores expired one by one, getting ensnared like blood-soaked flies in the sticky predatory web of Barnes & Noble and Borders. All this we accept as common wisdom, downing it dutifully with our soy milk lattes and muesli. But is it possible that there's more to the story than meets the eye?
Okay, so I am here with Alex Beckstead, who is the man behind Paperback Dreams. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Ed.
First off, I wanted to ask you, why did you single out, and this is a very general question, Kepler's and Cody's? I mean, there are a number of independent bookstores during that particular time. I mean, I don't know why you didn't go with, say, City Lights, which has been around since 1953, or even a clean, well-lighted place. What of this? What was there a particular decision? Did you sense a certain kind of decay with these particular two bookstores, or what?
Well, I knew Kepler's is probably the three of the stores of Cody's, Kepler's, and City Lights, which were the three San Francisco stores that all started around the same time. City Lights, I think, was 52, and then Kepler's in 55, and Cody's in 56. So they were pretty close together. They all knew each other. They used to advertise jointly in the San Francisco Chronicle together. So there was a definitely sort of a historic connection between the books. I probably knew Kepler's best because I used to work, less than a quarter mile from Kepler's.
Uh-huh.
As a documentary filmmaker, we end up buying and reading a lot of books regardless of the project. And so Kepler's was the store that I would go to. They used to do free local delivery, so I'd order books from them and they'd deliver them to my office. So when Kepler's closed, there's a lot of bookstores I've loved over the years that have gone away, and I had that sort of general sense that a lot of people who like books and like bookstores do, that it's a hard business, they're not doing well, it's sad when they close, but Kepler's felt a little bit different because it's really the last big independent bookstore in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And it's, Menlo Park is, 10 minutes from Stanford University. It's one of the best educated, wealthiest cities in America. There's really the closest thing that that Kepler's has to a town square, or I'm sorry, that Menlo Park has to a town square, is Kepler's and Cafe Baroni next door. I mean, it's where everybody goes on Sunday morning with the kids and the dog. You get breakfast at Baroni, and then you go next door and you browse books at Kepler's. So when Kepler's closed, it was sort of, this felt like much more serious than even all the other bookstore closings I've been sort of vaguely aware of over the years. So that was where I got started. And then right after that, I knew Cody's. I've never lived in Berkeley, but when I went to Berkeley, I used to go to Cody's. And I'd heard that they were opening this new store. So I quickly learned that Kepler's was going to be reopening. So it seemed like we had kind of two parallel stories. One of a bookstore that was being rescued by people who'd been very, very successful in, the modern business climate. And, they were going to be trying to figure out how to make a bookstore work as a business. And then the other story was a bookstore that had been historically very successful in Berkeley, but that was kind of falling on hard times and was making sort of a Hail Mary play to expand and, see if they could boost sales enough to save, what was really kind of an underperforming business.
I mean, I'm curious if you detected in both of these stories, these particular bookstores, some sense of possible failure in the air. I mean, Cody's expanding into San Francisco at the expense of their landmark. I mean, I was there at the time as well, and I even viewed this as something of a kind of folly. I mean, if you lived in that particular area or you looked at that particular area, I mean, that used to be a Planet Hollywood.
Right.
There was a Borders actually up the street, and there was a F.A. Schwartz that went belly up,
mm-hmm.
Just down the street from there. And so I'm curious if
Union Square is an interesting neighborhood. I mean, there's actually two Borders now within like a 3 or 4 block radius of Cody's.
Yeah.
The second one opened not long after Cody's on Stockton Street. But there's also a very large independent bookstore, Stacy's, that's not very far from there either. And Union Square is like a marquee shopping district. It's high-end brands, it's expensive retail, but it's a lot of foot traffic. And I think that, I didn't smell blood in the water. I didn't go in thinking, okay, well, this is going to be a failure. I mean, it was a huge risk, I mean, the kind of thing that Andy was doing, there was going to be a dramatic outcome one way or another. Either he wasn't going to make it and the losses were going to be catastrophic, or he was going to make it and sort of prove that, somewhere, somehow, an independent bookstore can still make it. I mean, that was the outcome I was rooting for.
Yeah.
But that's not what happened.
But simultaneously, you do have footage of Andy Ross as the bookstore is opening. He's saying very proudly in the streets how banks won't lend him money, how he's putting his entire savings into this Hail Mary, that we'll call it that, I suppose, because it did indeed go belly up. It seemed to me that, that you know, and at the end of the film, he even says this was a colossal act of hubris. I mean, this store was operational at the expense of the Telegraph store.
Well, I mean, the Telegraph store wasn't making money, is what people need to understand. You know, the Telegraph store, you know, was not going to survive. It might have limped along for another year or two had Andy not opened San Francisco, but it was losing a lot of money. The kind of books it historically sold were not selling well there. I think Andy's reasoning was, you know, when they opened the second store in Berkeley in 98, Cody's on 4th Street, that store became very successful very quickly. It was smaller than Telegraph. You know, Telegraph is, there's a whole other thing about Telegraph that, you know, it's always been a little bit edgy, but it's really just kind of gotten seedy. There's a high rate of vacancies along Telegraph Avenue. I was talking at one point when we were making the film with the owner of Amoeba Music, you know, that has a very large record store on Haight Street in San Francisco and then also one on Telegraph. And, you know, it's still not clear to me exactly who is to blame for the decline of Telegraph, but it's clear. I mean, he was saying there's hardly any vacancies on Haight Street. It's very similar in terms of, you know, the kind of people that spend time there. Similar problems with aggressive panhandling, with drug dealing, all those sorts of things. But, you know, but Haight Street does fine, and for some reason Telegraph does not. So, you know, Telegraph was in decline. 4th Street was really taking off as a shopping district. I can't remember the exact number, but it's something like 20 or 30% of all the sales tax revenue for the city of Berkeley comes from 4th Street.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Cody's was like the biggest shop on the block. They were kind of the anchor of 4th Street. So I think Andy's logic was, we opened a second store in a more upscale shopping neighborhood. That quickly became profitable. Not quite profitable enough to float Telegraph as well, but maybe if we did the same thing on a bigger scale, then we'd have two successful stores and one that was kind of slowly dying, but maybe we could subsidize it long enough to figure out what was going to happen. Or maybe Telegraph Avenue. I mean, there's been talk about turning Telegraph Avenue around for years, you know. So I think that he was really optimistic that he could do that. And yeah, and it wasn't the right call at the end of the day. I think the biggest mistake he made was that he says this in the film, you know, he didn't understand that San Francisco and Berkeley are, you know, they're not separated. I've been joking with people that the Bay Bridge isn't a bridge, it's the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
You know, it's a huge cultural divide. Even though San Francisco and Berkeley to outsiders seem very similar. I mean, you talk to anybody about Cody's in Berkeley, their eyes well up with tears. I've heard stories about people almost giving birth to their children in Berkeley, meeting their life partner in Berkeley or at Cody's.
I've had a lot of fun on that strip too.
Exactly. So. but then you just talk to someone in San Francisco and you talk about Cody's even now and they say, oh, didn't they just open a store in Union Square? You know, I mean, there's some sense of it, but it's
no sense of memory, no sense of a cultural touchstone.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, go over the bridge into New Jersey and talk to people about the Strand, and it's going to be a very different story, you know. And I think that was part of the miscalculation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but simultaneously, I should point out, as a glass of wine is poured, I should point out that in this particular film, you do point out that Cody's did manage to survive when the neighborhood along Telegraph was arguably seedier back in the 60s and 70s than it is now. And so you suggest that a lot of the success of both Cody's and Kepler's in this film has much to do with the countercultural movement of the time. And I'm wondering, is it a climate shift or is it really a kind of sense of passion? Because I know that at one point Andy Ross says, you know, there was nothing much that helped us except Harry Potter and everybody was selling Harry Potter. And he also says that, you know, it wasn't really much fun to run the store in the last 5 years or so.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, in the late 60s, early 70s, things weren't great on Telegraph for businesses, including Cody's. I mean, when Andy bought the store, you know, the Cody's were not doing well. I mean, part of the reason they were selling the store is because it was becoming a struggle for them. But right after Andy bought the store, there was kind of, Andy kind of came in at a good time, you know. He came in at sort of the golden age of independent bookstores. You know, there were, books were really popular. I mean, what was sort of like counterculture phenomenon, I think, in the 50s and 60s, where there were certain, you know, sort of an intellectual class that felt like they had to read certain books. you know, that went mainstream. It's sort of like when rock and roll went mainstream or anything else, as the counterculture got big and got out of just sort of like small university towns and urban centers. You know, this kind of like idea that you need to read books went along with it. Like every real estate developer in America that was putting in some kind of shopping center at the time wanted an independent bookstore because that was what would draw people in, and that was sort of, you know, the anchor tenant. And you also had computers coming down in price. Cody's was one of the first stores to computerize their inventory.
Yeah.
And, you know, and those kinds of things just helped with efficiencies that really made things pop. And so for the first, you know, 15, 20 years that Andy was running Cody's, it was a very good time to be running a bookstore. And there's, you know, there's a lot of bookstores that, you know, that are have been gone for a while now that sort of can't thank you. They came of age in that period and did very, very well. And then, you know, it's been a long, slow decline. But I don't remember what your question was.
The question is whether it was necessarily, I guess, a cultural shift, or whether it was an economic shift as to why Cody's was able to survive, or maybe it was a sense of passion. I mean, the original Cody's closed the store after 21 years because they figured it was
sort of like... After 50
years. Well, when Andy Ross took over the store, but they actually took it over...
He'd been there for almost 29 years.
Well, Ross had been there for 29
yeah.
years, but the original Cody's right. were there for 21 years. And so what I'm suggesting here, I mean, they said, well, we want to give up the store. It's kind of like raising a child and allowing someone to grow up and then kind of go off into their particular ways. But, I mean, do you think maybe the last 8 years that Andy Ross was there, that maybe he should have handed it off to someone who better understood the current change? I mean, it's very ironic that he had a computerized system in place and yet also simultaneously in this film rails against the developments of the internet, pointing out that it is misinformation and the like, when in fact, I could argue, I mean, here we are talking about a radio show that is in fact distributed through the internet, which is arguably beneficial for books.
I don't think it's fair to say the film rails against the internet, actually. I think, you know, I think
Andy
Ross rails against the internet.
That's what I say, yeah.
And I, you know, I mean, I use the internet to buy things. I use Amazon.com, you know. When I'm done eating this cheese plate and drinking this glass of wine, I'll probably pay for it with an Amazon.com Visa card that's in my pocket. I mean, it's not like, you know, I'm an enemy of the internet or an enemy of progress. I mean, you know, it's a good hypothetical question. You know, should Andy have passed the store on to somebody else? It assumes that there's a legion of people waiting in the wings to take over bookstores. You know, book selling in a good year, a bookseller will turn a 3% profit. You know, this is the number I hear from booksellers everywhere. You know, a good year is 3%. You know, up until recently, you know, you could put your money in an online savings account and get 4 or 5% interest. So think about all the work and labor that goes into running an independent bookstore when in a good year, you're going to make just more than half of the return you could get by just taking that same capital and just parking it in a savings account.
Sure.
You know, it's not a really great business as far as growth goes. And there's, you know, it's also a business that, you know, independent stores tend to be run by families, by individuals. You know, these aren't people who, you know, we've gotten to this position now in our culture where, you know, most people's jobs last 5 to 7 years and they're on to another position or they're on to another company or whatever. You know, running a bookstore for most people is a 20 to 30 year commitment. The turnover is very, very slow. You know, I mean, there was this kind of surge of bookstores in the mid-late 50s when the paperback revolution was happening. You had another surge in the late 70s when Andy was taking over Kepler's Andy was taking over Cody's and Clark Kepler was taking over Kepler's, and you had stores like a Clean, Well-Lighted Place opening up in San Francisco. You know, actually Borders started around that time as an independent bookstore in Minneapolis. I think it was 71. Michael Powell was starting Powell's Books first in Chicago and then, you know, a few years later in Portland. And we're kind of at a point now where a lot of those people are graying out, so it is kind of a time to be taking over. But you're asking, you know, it's a huge commitment. These businesses don't make a lot of money. It takes a lot of overhead. It's, you know, there's been sort of three speculative bubbles in America back to back to back, all of which have directly hurt booksellers, independent booksellers, in a very real way. The first one was the chain retail bubble that gave us Borders and Barnes & Noble. There's a bookseller, Tony Weller from Sam Weller's Books in Salt Lake, who was telling me that in the 10 years or so that Borders and Barnes & Noble were fighting with each other to be the biggest bookstore in America, they expanded the retail floor space in this country dedicated to selling books by about 400%. At the same time, the book market grew 10 to 15%. So what does that mean for independent bookstores? Well, first of all, it means that publishers have to fill all these shelves with books, which means they have to print a lot more books. But publishers, one of the strange things about the way the book business works, unlike, say, a clothing retailer who might buy a box of T-shirts, they don't sell those T-shirts. They just keep discounting them, moving them farther and farther back into the store until they're, you know, pennies on the dollar. Publishers will take that stock back and issue a credit to bookstores. All these extra books that weren't getting sold were coming back to publishers. They had to raise the price of books because they were suddenly having to generate all this, you know, all these books that weren't getting sold. You know, so there was, you know, there were things going on like that that were really, really putting a lot of pressure on independent bookstores. And you know, it was new and it was exciting. A lot of them were bigger than independent bookstores. A lot of them were better than some independent bookstores. Not every independent bookstore that died was like a great cultural icon. So that was thing number one. Thing number two was the internet bubble. You know, and Amazon was a big part of that. You know, suddenly everybody wanted to buy everything online. I moved to San Francisco, well, to the Bay Area anyway, in 1999. And it seemed like there was a time when, like, people were trying to buy everything online. People were getting a gallon of milk online. Yeah. You know, it was almost absurd. Like, things that nobody should ever be buying online, they're buying online just because of the novelty of it. And, you know, and Amazon was the Walmart of internet retailers. They were the first ones to really take off as an internet retailer. And that was always what they wanted to do. You know, my understanding is that Amazon was never trying to be the world's biggest bookstore. They were trying to crack the internet retailing code. And they did. To their credit, they did. You know, books were a product that made a lot of sense for them to be their first thing because of the way they could manage the inventory, because of the ordering process, because of returns, because of a lot of things. So that was thing number two. And bookstores like Cody's that were close to universities, you know, people like university professors, college students, grad students, you know, the sort of people who historically read books are also the kind of people who were early adopters. So their core customers were flocking to the internet. That was speculative bubble number two that really hurt Cody's. And speculative bubble number three was the real estate market. I mean, that's what closed Kepler's originally, was they had to renegotiate their lease.
Yeah.
You know, and this is, you know, one of the bookstores that are doing well, a shocking number of them own their buildings.
Yeah.
You know, Cody's didn't own their building on Telegraph. But they owned half of it, but they didn't own, you know, most of it. It was two buildings that were sort of connected. These were all things that, you know, raise the cost of business for bookstores. You know, when their business wasn't really going up, when readership was kind of in decline, a lot of the historic roles that books played as far as sources of information and that kind of thing were being eaten up by the internet as well. So it's not just Amazon. It used to be, if you wanted to know what beavers ate in the Sacramento River Delta, you had to go find the Sacramento River Delta beaver book. And now you just Google it, yep. You know. It's completely changed what people need books for. It changed the kind of books that were published, and it changed the kind of role the bookstores played in the community.
But you mentioned the word earlier, graying. And I think that that's you said graying.
Graying, yeah, okay.
And I think that that's a very important word. I mean, you have in this film you actually photograph the 50th anniversary of Cody's. And I was struck, even though the film doesn't explicitly mention this, by the number of people there who were over 40. Nearly all of them were. And I think I saw maybe one person who was under 40. I mean, clearly, the business model that Andy Ross, and perhaps to some degree Clark Kepler, although Kepler did in fact listen to his customer base, maybe he may not be giving the people what they want. Isn't an independent bookstore a business like anything else? I mean, shouldn't they listen to what the customers want? And this is why I sort of propose that maybe Andy kind of got burned out after maybe 20 years. I don't know if his passion was entirely into it. That's, of course, subject to the audience who will watch the film, but it seems very clear that his passion isn't into it as it was, say, 10 years ago, whereas Kepler is lighting up.
I would really take strong exception with saying that Andy's passion wasn't into it. I mean, I think, you know, he took an enormous... There's a lot of flaws with what Andy did in the management of Cody's that led to its decline, but I think lack of passion was certainly not on the list. You know, I mean, if anything, I think he was too passionate. I think he still so deeply believed in the idea of a Cody's-type bookstore, a large general bookstore with an intellectual bent that, you know, could really stand out as a cultural landmark, you know, and not just, you know, where it had been for 50 years and sort of earned that reputation, but that, like, a smart community was going to recognize the value of a Cody's. You know, it was his passion that made him believe that, you know. It's because it's what he believed. It didn't pan out. And you're right. I mean, you know, booksellers have to be smart and follow their customers. And it's a huge challenge. I think part of the reason why you see so many gray hairs at a lot of book readings, and not all of them. You know, I have another San Francisco bookstore, The Booksmith on Haight Street,
sure.
which actually has new owners now, over a year ago. You know, this has come up a couple times when they've been around, and they love to talk about their Chuck Palahniuk event, you know, where there's nobody over 30, and they, you know, sold tickets to get into the reading, and it was like a huge success for them. And both those things are true. I mean, you know, I'm in my mid-30s. I know a lot of people who read, and it's not just, you know, the sort of, like, intelligentsia-type folks, you know, friends who went to grad school or in PhD programs or whatever. It's like, you know, moms. It's like my friends who are, like, you know, basically housewives now. They're all in book clubs. They're all reading. What's been lost, I think, has been the sense of independent bookstores as a cultural space, as some, you know, as a place where you went to find out about things, as a place where you went to, you know, find out what the new idea was, or to bump into people who were going to be interesting, or to bump into ideas that have been interesting. I don't think that's stopped happening in independent bookstores. For whatever reason, our generation is sort of doesn't see it that way anymore, and the generation that did see it that way is graying out. So, and it's not all bookstores. I mean, there are, you know, I mean, like, I'm really actually excited to be screening tonight at McNally Jackson, because McNally Jackson's doing very well. I mean, they're not a very old store. I believe they expanded recently, you know, and there, you know, there's a lot of young people there, and booksellers around the country are actually excited about them, because it's sort of like, here's a bookstore with young people that's new, that's doing well. I actually run an office from Green Apple Books in San Francisco. It's a similar story. It's a young clientele. It's younger owners. So there's places where this is happening, but I just think across the board it's not as valued as it used to be. I think, you know, in the late 70s, when you talk about people who thought independent bookstores were culturally important, you were talking about a large percentage of the population. And when you talk about that now, you're not.
Yeah. But I mean, what I'm suggesting here is that listening to how the human relationship to the bookstore is changing, as Clark Kepler did, is perhaps a valuable thing to do. I mean, you know, you interview Mr. Powell, and he likewise says, well, you have to think with some sense of entrepreneurship if you want to survive in this really tough business.
Yeah, let me talk about that, because that's a really good point. And I think, you know, you talk to the old-time Kepler's folks, and there's still like three of them left in Silicon Valley, right? We interviewed one of them, Ira Samperl, who's great. But, you know, a lot of them do not like what Kepler's has become. Because what Kepler's has become is a really, really great sort of family bookstore. It's not that they only sell kids' books. They sell a lot. I mean, they do very well with their children's section. They won, you know, what's sort of like the Nobel Prize for children's sections last year. It's called the Pinnell Award. It's like the big, you know, prize for... They name a... one children's bookstore and one children's section in America is the best in the country, and Kepler's won that distinction last year. And they, and you know, and because it's an educated community, they sell a lot of other kinds of books, and they still sell a lot of serious books. It you would not be able to describe Kepler's as a counterculture hangout anymore.
No.
You know, it's a very smart store. It's not a radical fringe store anymore. So yeah, Kepler's followed their customers, but it changed what the store is. And maybe that's okay. You know, I'm actually not passing a value judgment on whether that's right or wrong. But I think when you talk about bookstores, like when you talk about anyone, you know, bookstores are really, they're a culturally based business. You know, they occupy a similar sort of space, I think, in the community landscape, like a movie theater, or like a theater group, or like, those sorts of businesses where, on the one hand, you have to sell enough tickets or sell enough books or, you know, record stores or sell enough, you know, albums to keep the doors open. There are certain things you're going to have to sell because it's going to be what people want. But you also have a role and a responsibility to further the art or the culture of whatever it is that you're doing. You know, sometimes you have to show a film that's controversial. Sometimes, because you think it's important. Sometimes you need to sell a book, you know, that isn't going to be a bestseller. You're not going to sell a lot of copies, but you personally feel committed to what it stands for or what it's about, so you put it on the shelves. So, you know, booksellers are sort of stuck in this double role where they're trying to lead their customers in a way, as sort of like, you know, in their role as progenitors of literary culture. But at the same time, they do have to follow their customer demands. And it's a constant balance that booksellers struggle with. You know, every bookseller has the store they want to run and the store they feel like they have to run. And, you know, and one of the common themes I see in stores that are really struggling is they're having a hard time letting go of the store that they want to run. And they're just not passionate about the store they have to run, you know.
I'm glad you brought up a movie theater, because I should point out that a movie theater is going to make most of its money. It's essentially a glorified snack bar. It pays out 95% of the ticket receipts back to the studios. And so that's why we have marked up popcorn, candy, you know, soda and all that.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
I'm wondering if perhaps this may very well be the future of the independent bookstore if it wants to survive. That it has to think more like being a essentially a glorified cafe with books as a community center. As in order, I mean, you have Kepler's, for example, diversifying its stock, selling things that are certainly not book-like in order to actually make some money.
And Kepler's is not unique. I mean, yeah, the sidelines business is something that's that all bookstores have to do. You know, I've been on this little sort of tour of bookstores, and there's it's interesting. Like Village Books in Bellingham, Washington, fantastic bookstore, great booksellers. They have a whole sort of stationary gift shop next door. I mean, it's basically sort of two businesses, one that's subsidizing the other. I mean, it actually makes sort of what Kepler's has done look a little bit, you know, withdrawn. You know, I mean, they've really done a lot in that respect. Vroman's in Pasadena, which was just, you know, this last year was the Publisher's Weekly, you know, independent bookseller of the year. Great bookstore, huge space. They've been in Pasadena for, I think, almost 100 years. They sell a lot of non-book items. We did the screening at Vroman's, and like somebody joked at one point, you could kind of see some books off in the distance from the event space.
Yeah.
But you know, we were surrounded by greeting cards and Christmas tree ornaments and everything else. You know, I mean, yeah, it's this is again. I think it's really similar to that. What I was saying about finding some kind of balance between making a living and furthering your culture. I mean, it's really no different from being an independent filmmaker. You know, I mean, very few independent documentary filmmakers make a living doing documentaries. They either have a day job or else they have other work that they do, or they do, you know, some of them are lucky enough to have family money. But you know, it's really, really hard. And these are all passion-based businesses. Again, it's like, you know, none of these, you have to stop and ask yourself, like, think about Village Books again. Think about two storefronts side by side, basically two businesses. One is profitable, one is not. Like, from a business point of view, it should be a no-brainer. You close the one that isn't profitable and you keep the other one going. But that's not why they're doing it. They're doing it because they think books are important and they think that the role of a bookstore in the community is important. I mean, they're deeply, you know, Chuck and Dee Robinson, like most of the independent booksellers I've met, are deeply, deeply passionate about that, to the point where it's almost like a community, you know, it's almost like a religious calling on some level. You know, they're selling the books to the community not because they can become, you know, wealthy or really even sustainable doing it, but because they feel like that's their role in the community. That's what they have to give and have to offer, and they'll figure out a way to make a living that lets them keep doing that.
Well, that brings up two questions. One I'll ask you now. I mean, Clark Kepler, I don't want to take away from him, but he started off not wanting to actually go off into the book business, and then when his father was dying of Parkinson's disease and was going to sell off the store, he then took over the business. It then became a sort of calling, this duty, this religiosity to some degree that you're suggesting. I'm wondering if that's what it takes, that now if you run an independent bookstore, it is out of some kind of philanthropy now.
Philanthropy might be a little bit too strong a word, but because I don't think that booksellers see themselves as giving charity out. But I do think it's out of... But, you know, booksellers... I mean, someone in the film says this. I think it's Jamie Robb. I should know my own film, but I think it was Jamie Robb, who's the publisher from Warner Books, says, you know,
the
only reason you go into bookselling is because you have a passion for books. And that's true. I mean, you know, it's because they think that books are important. They think that, you know, having a local community store where people in the community are looking for books that reflect their community's values, or that should reflect their community's values, or that are valuable to their community, or that will be enjoyable to their community, whatever it is. It's about being, you know, connected with, you know, the intellectual life of your local community. I mean, that's what lights booksellers up. Clark's an interesting case because he, you know, as is shown in the film, that wasn't his like driving passion from day one. I think he kind of got, you know, pulled into it for family reasons. But I think one of the big lessons that Clark learned in the sort of dramatic closing and reopening of Kepler's is that he realized just how important what he did was to his community. I don't think he fully understood that before Kepler's closed and reopened. I mean, I think there was sort of a sense of like, oh, people like Kepler's. But I think it showed him, you know, I think it made him take his job a lot more seriously. Not that he didn't before, but I think it really drove home to him, you know, what I do is meaningful. What I do means a lot to a lot of people, regardless of whether it shows up on the balance sheet or not.
Yeah. Do you think that the conglomeratization of publishers has something to do with the fall of independent bookstores. I mean, there hasn't been anything even remotely like the firebombing of Cody's for the Satanic Verses in the last 10 years. I mean, publishers have really been playing it safe with the books that they choose. And so as a result, if you decide to go to a sort of big box store or independent bookstore, you're essentially going to get the same stock. You're probably going to get more variety in the independent bookstore, but nevertheless, that that great swath of many voices is diminishing further.
And well, so there's, I think, let me answer the question this way. I think there's, you know, we talk, there's a lot of numbers that make you pessimistic about what's happening with book readership. I mean, you know, the statistic that I still feel stunned every time I think about it, you know, that I, and I can't remember where I read this, but it was, you know, that, you know, the average, there's half of all Americans don't even read a book in a given year. You know, there's only half of the country that's even going to bother to read a book.
The Reading at Risk report you're citing?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was it. You know, and there's, you know, depending on how you I mean, book sales are definitely down. You know, depending on how, although it's hard to say, Amazon actually doesn't really say how many books they sell, so nobody really knows for sure what's going on there. Maybe some of the book sales are going there. But the one thing that is going in the other direction is more books are published, more titles are published now every year than ever before. And some of that's because of self-publishing, some of that's because of print-on-demand, some of that's because of smaller publishers coming in and taking risks. So I think that, you know, why has there not been something like as controversial as sort of like culturally important as the Satanic Verses? I mean, I think there, I think part of the reason, I mean, I don't know. That's a question I actually don't know the answer to. But I think what happens with one of the roles that booksellers have traditionally played, and I think that this is actually, like, record stores are a very different example. I mean, I love record stores. I've actually never worked in a bookstore, but I've worked in several record stores. And, you know, and I still love going to, you know, the local record stores we have left in San Francisco, Aquarius and The Mission and Amoeba on Haight Street. But the MP3 is a fundamentally different thing than a CD. The distribution channel really has changed. Books really haven't changed. I mean, in spite of the Kindle and a few things that are sort of, you know, chipping away at the edges, like, I mean, the book really hasn't changed much other than going into paperbacks in like 500 years. What other technology from 500 years ago is still as ubiquitous as the book is? Like maybe the fork and spoon? You know, I mean, it's something that's really held on. The investment to find out if you like an album or a song is small. It's a few seconds to listen to a song and decide if you want to go to the end of 3 minutes. Maybe it's 3 to 10 minutes to listen to a few songs and decide if the album's worthwhile. Or at the outside, maybe, you know, an hour and a half to listen to the whole album. In an hour and a half, it's still very hard to tell with a lot of books if they're going to be worth reading. Yeah. You know, the sort of what you have to put into it as a reader is a lot more than you have to put into it as a listener. So while the internet, I think, actually, because of the speed with which people can sort of sample music, I think that, you know, in some ways the internet hasn't been terrible for diversity when it comes to music, because suddenly through music blogs, through MySpace, through like all these kinds of things, music's getting passed around very quickly on the web, and people are sifting through a lot more of it probably than they were before. That's really not the case with books. You know, you still need gatekeepers with books. I mean, you still need gatekeepers with music too, but, you know, it requires a certain kind of person who's going to read a lot, who's going to be thoughtful about it, who's going to get to know people, you know, in a little bit deeper way to find out what they like and be able to recommend a book to them. And as there's fewer and fewer independent booksellers, there's fewer and fewer gatekeepers. You know, I was doing a radio show yesterday on WAMU in Washington, D.C., and there was a caller who called in who was complaining about independent booksellers, saying, you know, she was a self-published author and she couldn't get the independent booksellers to carry her book. And, you know, that she thought they should help her and they didn't, and that made her very mad. And I was sort of thinking about that. I wish I'd said this on the air, but, you know, if all we have is Borders and Barnes & Noble, and it's really just going to be Barnes & Noble. You know, Borders is for sale. Yeah. You know, they have serious cash flow problems. Yeah. Like, you know, the word on the street is that, you know, Borders probably will not be around next year. So, but best case scenario, let's say they survive. You've got Borders and Barnes & Noble. You've basically got two people making national buying decisions for these two chains. You know, good luck being a self-published author then. You know, you get two...
Good luck being an independent, because these stores also make incredible demands of the covers, I've heard, and of the content, and it's excising certain passages that might be considered dangerous or not sellable.
I hear a lot of these rumors, too, and I think somebody from Borders or Barnes & Noble should speak up about it, but... But what I'm saying is we're going to have two gatekeepers, basically, for new books. You know, Shelley, the caller, the self-published author, you know, maybe there's three or four independent booksellers that won't carry her book, but maybe there's three or four who are. Maybe Shelley's book is awful. Maybe Shelley's book is fantastic. The more gatekeepers we have, the more likely you are to find, you know, somebody who will take a chance on something new. And, you know, there's, I mean, it's interesting, I'm going to have to look at his name. He's one of the booksellers on our panel tonight. I was reading some notes he sent me in advance. I think it was from someone from Book Culture. Chris Doblin, I think.
Yeah.
Is he Book Culture? Do you
know? Yeah, he's Book
Okay, Book. I want to make sure I got the right bookstore. So Chris Doblin from Book Culture mentioned to me in an email, he was talking about how important he thinks it is there still are sort of niche stores, because certain topics need to be seen from a certain perspective or from certain communities. The example he used was, you know, gay and lesbian readers. There's, you know, that's still a community that has a particular perspective on culture, on life, on politics. You know, if we get to the point where all there is a couple national general bookstores, those kinds of voices and those kinds of segments of the audience get marginalized. You know, so long as you still have independence, you'll have, you know, a gay and lesbian leaning bookstore that really has that point of view on what's important. You know, that, you know, for it may seem like, you know, a smaller population, but if you're part of that community, you know, that's your whole life. I mean, that's, you know, really like your worldview that's getting pushed out and set aside. So it's pretty significant, I think. You know, the reduction in the number of gatekeepers.
Yeah. But, I mean, the rise of Cody's and Kepler's, and this will be my last question because I know we got to get going, the rise of these independent bookstores came about because of the counterculture, because of people throwing firebombs into Cody's because of the satanic verses, even with City Lights because of Hal, because they had the bravery to challenge the gatekeepers to provide alternative voices in a manner that, you know, B. Dalton or whoever else would never actually touch. You know?
I mean, well, to be fair, I mean, Cody's had been in business for, you know, almost, well, over 30 years, like 35 years by the time they were bombed for selling the satanic verses. So I wouldn't give that too much credit for putting them on the map.
Well, but still, there's also, of course, like, you know, the riots and all that.
I think it's a bigger cultural thing. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, what, you know, what one of the things that happened with the paperback revolution was, you know, it made books dangerous. You know, there were, the House Un-American Activities Committee was holding hearings on paperback books. Not on particular titles, mind you, but on the format of paperback books, because they were concerned that it was going to be nothing but a platform for smut and pornography, and it was going to, you know, destroy American values. You know, it's funny to think about, like, the paperback book as being something that was that seen as that dangerous. But it was. And, you know, traditional carriage trade bookstores that dealt in hardcovers that had sort of a client list, you know, a lot of these stores, you didn't even get to handle the books. They're behind a counter and somebody brought them to you, you know. Those stores really looked down their nose at paperback books. They were cheap, trashy things that were sold in drug stores that, you know, that weren't of any value. So there was really an entrepreneurial opportunity there. The counterculture in the 60s and 70s swept into. And, you know, and something like that will come along again, whether it's for publishing or for whatever it is. I mean, the internet has been that in many ways. But the difference, I think, between what happened with paperbacks and the counterculture and the internet, I think that paperbacks and the counterculture and independent bookstores did more to introduce people to ideas that maybe they hadn't really thought about. The internet seems to just be pushing us more and more into little groups of people who all kind of think the same. You know, like, there's, you know, I don't know if you spend much time on discussion groups online. I've been part of a few from time to time. And inevitably, I end up kind of dissatisfied with it because there's usually some period of sort of fruitful discussion. And then it just settles down to people who pretty much have the same opinions. If your opinion's too different, people run away.
Not on my side.
Well,
have you checked out my blog?
I have checked out your blog a little bit. Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, it's almost to the point where you get these sort of like dueling ideologies. Like, you know, there's certain, you know, you can't be too far right on, you know, the daily costs, and you can't be, you know, there's just certainly things that, for better or worse, that's sort of how the internet works. I think it does a lot. It's a good feedback loop. It makes us feel good about, you know, what we think already. It's not very good at challenging what we think. And something needs to emerge in that space. You're shaking your head. You disagree about the internet?
I think it's very good at challenging what, I mean, granted, the people who run the websites need to have an open mind. I will approve just about any comment on my site, even if someone wants to, you know, say, you know, hey, Mr. Champion, we'd like to go ahead and kill you or something. I've had that. And I get emails like that all the time. But the point is that the importance of the internet is that it is this countercultural medium in some sense, or perhaps a kind of a reboot on that level.
Yeah, I mean, I think the internet's, and there's actually, there's a great book you can look up, What the Dormouse Said by John Markoff, which is actually a book about how the 60s counterculture that was so active in the Bay Area helped give rise to sort of the ethos of the personal computer. And, you know, the personal computer has become an extension of personal expression, which is great. And, you know, the internet is sort of about community, but it's really like about a community of individuals. You know, I think a lot of these sites, the bar to entry to most of the communities online is very low. You know, what's expected from people to be part of an online community is very, very low. Even civility. I mean, you know, it's like you want to venture into like the third ring of hell. You know, go to any major newspaper site, find an article on any controversial topic, whether it's gay marriage or the war in Iraq or politics, just start reading the comments.
Yeah.
You know, like, people do not talk like that to each other face to face. You know, I don't think the internet has been particularly good at building, you know, real cohesive, nuanced human community.
I agree with you on to some degree. I mean, there is certainly a lot of that, but
it's
I also think there's a lot of good civil disagreements, thoughtful disagreements online. I mean, in fact, it might argued, to bring it back to the subject of books, I mean, Amazon is not really a gatekeeper because any book can be published. You can actually, as a self-published author, get an ISBN number and sell your book online through Amazon if you really wanted to.
That's true. You know, and I mean, the internet, and again, this is why I don't think the internet is evil. I think that the internet has been very democratic in a lot of ways. That's the upside of the internet. I mean, Amazon is very democratic. You're right. Just about anybody can sell their book on Amazon or through Amazon. You can buy a stack of books and sell them out of your garage on Amazon, you know? And those are good things. I mean, I think that kind of like personal empowerment and that kind of democratization, I'm all for that. But there, you know, but the pendulum is swinging very far that direction very quickly. And, you know, not every independent bookstore is a good gatekeeper. Not everything that an independent bookseller recommends is worth reading. But some of them are, and the good ones, you know, it's getting to a point where even for the good ones to remain viable is very, very hard. And there's just, you know, the Andy quotes T.S. Eliot, you know, in the film. This was from a speech he gave on Cody's 50th birthday. You know, and the line he quotes is, "Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information?" And I really feel like in the golden age of the books of the independent bookstore in the late 70s, early 80s, thinking was still highly valued. It wasn't just the facts that you know or the information that you had. It was how you connected it and how you interpreted it and what you thought it meant. I think we've become a much, much more information-based culture now. You know, we have access to an enormous amount of information, far more than any of us can sift through, understand, analyze. You know, we all kind of get some piece of
it. Isn't it great?
It is great. I mean, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. But I think that if you want to be... but having information does not make you informed, and you know, and it doesn't. Having the facts doesn't always give you an idea of what you should think about it. And I think there are some of us who, you know, some people. I won't say some of us because then it sounds like I feel like I'm one of these people, and I'm trying, but who knows? I think some people are better at the analysis than others. You know, I mean, we've probably all had that experience of reading a book and going, "That's what I thought," you know, like I mean, where you've had this experience and somebody sort of like connects the dots or connects some facts and you think, yeah, I just never could quite put that together, but that's sort of how it works.
But Alex, you could say the same thing about books. Someone could take a stack of books and some people are better at understanding books than others. I mean, it's the same kind of argument. I mean, going back to how people process information and tying this into the independent bookseller, I mean, how does an independent bookseller compete with the ubiquity of Amazon where every book is available?
Like I said, I think it really just depends on what you think the role of a bookseller is. If the role of a bookseller is to give you access to every book in print on any topic as soon as you want it, actually they still kind of do that because the fact of the matter is that, you know, there's very the other consolidation thing that's happened in the book business is consolidation of distributors. Amazon doesn't keep many new books in their warehouse anymore. When you buy a book on Amazon, most of the time it's coming from the same Ingram warehouse that an independent bookseller is getting it from. So, you know, other than like the convenience of being able to do it from your desk rather than having to walk into a bookstore, like, you know, that's really not the case. But I don't think that's the role of an independent bookseller at all anymore. And I'm not sure it ever really was.
A gatekeeper or a community center.
Exactly. I think that's it. It's about having a point of view. It's about caring enough about the life of the mind or about literature or about some particular community, whether it's your neighborhood or whether it's, you know, some, you know, community that's organized around a political belief or whether it's, you know, like Marcus Books in San Francisco, which is a great African-American bookstore. You know, they have a role in serving that community and in doing their best to sift through this information for you to make what they think is important more accessible to you. And sometimes they're going to get it right, sometimes they're going to get it wrong. But then you have two people, you know, or more than two people sort of like sifting through all this stuff. That's why I think the gatekeeping role is so important. You know, I mean, one of the major publishers, this is sort of secondhand, told a bookseller friend of mine recently, one of their sales reps, that for certain kinds of books, like literary fiction and political nonfiction, not necessarily the biggest selling books in the world, but sort of like, for lack of a better word, thought leader books, the kind of books that really sort of will impact the people who are going to be culturally influential. In the first 6 months of new titles, 40% of those sales happen in independent bookstores, you know, which are like 10 to 15% of the book market. And what that says is this is still where innovation is happening in the book business. This is where people will take a chance on a new title, they'll take a chance on a new writer. And that's part of the gatekeeping role too, you know. And it works so long as there's a lot of them. If there's just a few of them, it's not so good to have gatekeepers, you know. If there's sort of like a happy medium here. I mean, I think in my perfect world, you've got the gatekeepers and you've got the internet. You know, you've got them both. It's not an either or question for me, you know. And I think that one thing that is pretty clear is if you think that's important, if you think it's important to have that gatekeeping role, if you think having a knowledgeable bookseller is important to you as a reader, then you have to support them with your dollars. You know, I mean, you have to go buy books from independent bookstores. And if you don't think it's important, then you won't. And independent booksellers will go away. And, you know, time will tell whether that was good or bad for our culture. I obviously think it would be very bad. Otherwise, I wouldn't have spent the last 3 years making this film and running around the country and trying to put it in front of people. But you know that's basically kind of what it comes down to. I mean, so a friend of mine once said, "Well, this seems like it's all just a question of values," and it is a question of values. You know, if you value human thinking, if you think that, you know, another human being besides you may be better sometimes at recognizing what's important than you are, then places like independent bookstores are very, very important.
Well, Alex, thanks for taking the time out. It was a pleasure chatting.
Thank you, Ed. It was my pleasure. And you know, please, if you want to find out more about the film, you can go to paperbackdreams.com. There's information there about broadcasts on your local public television station or screenings at your local bookstore. You can also order the DVD. Feel free to post comments, send us an email, tell us what you think. We'd be happy to hear from you.
Okay, thank you.
Tomorrow never comes, or so the saying goes. So take each precious moment and make it last. It's all been said before, it's true, I know it's true. The present is the future of the past. So now I'm living in a caveman's dream. No open fire, no nearby stream. No animal skins all fit for me. I got electric light and a lavatory. Yeah.